It's June 6th, 2016, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, a conversation about migration and politics at the University of Amsterdam. I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran. Now, today we're going to return to the EU-Turkey deal. A month ago, Frank Devel from Oxford joined the podcast and explained why European governments were going to have a really hard time keeping up their end of the deal. Now, since the start of the year, Turkey has been putting in place a variety of measures to ensure that Syrians will find meaningful, albeit temporary, protection. They've even offered Syrian nationals work permits. But in some somewhat surprising news, it appears that Syrian nationals have been really slow to apply for the right, with less than 1% responding to the government's offer. Here to talk about these issues is Can Mutlu from the Acadia University in Canada and Bilkent in Turkey. Can is currently working and living in Turkey, and he's long studied how governments document, survey, and control mobile populations. Hi, Can.
Hello.
Can, now, you've argued that accessing legal and decent employment in Turkey is one of the major challenges facing Syrian refugees today. So if that's the case, what's gone wrong with the rollout of this work permit scheme?
I think one of the major issues that we're seeing in the field is the difficulty between the correspondence from the official government offices and the sort of the people on the ground who are actually supposedly granting these permits. There seems to be a reluctance to sort of issue these permits, apply for these permits, and the general information that these permits are now available is becoming sort of, they're having a bit of a difficulty expressing this information to the public because the Syrian population is quite dispersed around Turkey and that the information does not disseminate in the same way that it disseminates among sort of academics and the people that are experts in the field. So they seem to be having a bit of a public relations problem reaching out to the Syrians. And secondarily, I think Syrians who are already working are working. They're working under the table, they're working in sort of more precarious employment situation, and then people who are going to still employ them are the same people. So they're not sure what difference this permit's going to make for them. So that's one of the issues that I think we're seeing.
I mean, I guess in a European situation or scenario, you would expect people to be, you know, lining up at the door to apply for these sorts of permits, partly because of a rigorous enforcement and inspection scheme on the continent. Is that lacking in Turkey? Are people simply not scared of that sort of enforcement? Or what's the case in Turkey?
Turkey has major issues with its own population in terms of employment, let alone with the Syrians. The unemployment rate for Turkish citizens is around 10%, and when you take that to sort of a youth unemployment, you're looking at 25 to 30% youth unemployment. So there's already sort of an environment where the employer is determining the conditions of employment in most of these places. So yes, there is issues with government oversight, not in terms of sort of social security or taxation, because even though most people who are employed are paying taxes, there are some tax problems as well. What we're seeing is a general sort of culture that this is sort of basically it's been 4 years when Syrians have been here. Those that are already employed are employed. And that like there is no real sort of incentive to go and seek out these official, you know, permits and stuff. It's basically taking people away from work for a day or two for something that is not going to change all that very much, because people like the conditions of this permit is that they're going to be integrated. The people who can sort of apply for these permits are going to be integrated into the social security net of Turkey. But the problem is most of the employers are already finding loopholes within that social security network for Turks, let alone for Syrians. So there is really no real incentive. Whereas in Europe, what you're saying makes sense because there is an incentive. Like once people are integrated into the social security network, they're given a bunch of different benefits and perks and sort of, you know, safeties associated with being part of a social security network. Whereas in Turkey, that's lacking. The culture is lacking. So I think that's the calculation that these temporarily protected people, Syrians, Iraqis, Afghans, are making. Once again, this also is not just for Syrians. This new law and regulation does also apply to Iraqis, Afghans, and other third country nationals who are under the temporary protection in Turkey.
Given the apparent lack of a need for such a permit or lack of take-up, what do you explain the motivation of the government for offering it in the first place? I mean, is this a gesture designed to satisfy the Europeans? Is it simply something designed to appease the UNHCR? What's behind this move?
I don't think that UNHCR actually at all plays a role in this calculation. I think this is particularly a negotiation between Turkey and the European Union. I haven't seen really the sort of main text of the treaty. In the sense that we've all seen it, but I think there is something behind the scenes that we don't know about. And I get the feeling that this is one of those things that is part of the sort of EU-Turkey treaty and, in a way, part of the readmission treaty. Because one of the problems that we're seeing is that the readmission treaty is widely misinterpreted by the general public in Turkey. That the Turkish public consider that treaty to be a part of the visa waiver process and not as part of the Syrian crisis. So the readmission treaty is not understood properly. And I think this whole talk of, you know, EU paying Turkey $3 billion euros and this and that is all part of this wider ecosystem of, you know, trying to find a more sustainable solution to 2.5 million Syrians living in Turkey. That's I think the main issue here is that this is not understood properly. The permit is not understood properly. I think the Turkish government is trying to do its best, but it's not really sort of capable. Turkey is not a Western European country with the same resources and the history of migration management. We've always assumed that this country was a transit country. But I think that now the fear that we're seeing very commonly is that Turkey is going to become a country sort of not that different than Pakistan in relation to the conflict in Afghanistan, a bordering country which has somewhat of a stable situation, but also has its own conflicts and has own sort of fragilities, and that might be the big concern here. So I think the work permit is seen as a step towards a sustainable solution to the Syrians, and the sort of the previous law that was passed in 2013 on the sort of temporary protection of non-nationals was also towards that step. But obviously problems with implementation persist.
Now, given this gap that you're talking about between the sorts of protection that's offered in Turkey and the sort of protection that's offered in Europe, I mean, what sort of protection do you think Syrians can really expect in the Turkish context? Particularly given that in Europe, this work permit's no doubt going to be held up as an example of all the benefits on offer for the people who are going to be returned under the current EU-Turkey deal.
I think I want to take a step back and look at the legal conditions, because one of the biggest misconceptions, and this happens in Turkey as well, is the sort of the language we use to describe Syrians, Iraqis, Afghans living in Turkey. Unlike Europe, where these people become asylum seekers, in Turkey they're not, right? Because Turkey has a geographical exception to the Geneva Convention saying that people coming from the east of Turkey cannot apply for asylum or refugee status in Turkey. That they can become guests or temporary protected individuals, but Turkish law does not put these individuals, and at this point 2.4 million Syrians, closer to I think 3 million if you add all the other nationalities together, not in the same, for example, Geneva Convention UNHCR status. And that I think creates in the short term a sort of a desirable position for Turkey, because or Syrians, because they can enter Turkey and they can escape the conflict. But in the longer term, I think it makes their status more precarious. So to sort of then take a point and try to think about what will happen in the long term, what kind of challenges that we're looking at, is that it obviously makes Turkey less desirable than Europe, because whereas in Europe, Syrians, once they successfully apply for asylum, can get education, healthcare, work permit, you know, subsidy of some like financial subsidies, they can't in Turkey. Or when they do, it's at the whim of the government. And right now the government is humanitarian in discourse and in practice to a certain extent, and does provide, you know, assistance to a certain extent. But what will happen if the government changes, or what will happen if Turkey goes through another financial crisis? These are big questions. Turkey is not giving them the international standard humanitarian recognition that European countries do. So there's always that incentive to go to Europe. There's always that incentive to find a better life in Europe.
You paint a portrait of, I guess, what looks like a long-term exclusionary policy towards Syrians, in that whilst they'll be included marginally and allowed to reside and not subject to deportation, we're likely to see Syrians living on the margins of Turkish society for the foreseeable future. What sorts of outgrowths of this sort of pattern of exclusion are you likely to see in the short term, maybe the long term as well?
So the answer to that is yes and no, in the sense that they actually have a clear path to Turkish citizenship. So people who do get the official residency permit from the Migration Management Directorate General do have the path within 5 years of their original application to become Turkish citizens. So someone who entered Turkey at the beginning of the conflict and has lived in Turkey continuously could foreseeably become a Turkish citizen this year. So that gives them a legal gate, like sort of opening into becoming, you know, regular this and that. But that doesn't solve the question of language, integration, access into healthcare, access into education. I was talking to a colleague the other day who was saying that around 400,000 Syrian children are in Turkey with no real access into education because they don't know Turkish, and that Turkish state is offering either sort of, temporary education through religious institutes and this and that, and or, you know, curriculum that is continuation of the Syrian curriculum instructed by Syrian teachers who are in Turkey. But that doesn't provide a path into Turkish integration. There is no foresight into sort of how these people will be integrated. Secondary problem, and that's a bigger problem, is healthcare. There is, you know, polio has long been eradicated in southeastern Turkey and Syria. It's making a comeback. We're not really talking about this because, you know, conflict doesn't lend itself to vaccination programs. And another problem is, and I'm rephrasing these as problems not because they're problems, but rather because in the long term they have the potential to become public health or education problems. There is about 150,000, 140,000 Syrian children born in Turkey since the start of the conflict. Their citizenship is questionable because they don't have official Syrian papers, but they can't also get Turkish papers because of the jus sanguini that we apply. These are all have the potential to become big problems. And work permit is just one of the solutions, but it's not the solution. There is no golden bullet here.
So, I mean, these are a range of different problems, which I really think from the European side, we're not seeing in the EU-Turkey deal. Some of the other issues that you've dealt with in your own research has to do with the collection of data on foreign nationals and the security issues underlying this deal. Could you just speak to us a little bit about what you're finding there?
Of course. So I've been looking specifically at the sort of identification technologies surrounding the Syrian non-nationals living in Turkey, which is, I'm interested in the question of biometrics in particular and how biometrics has become basically a solution in a way from the policy perspective of identifying Syrians. Because there's a twofold problem. First is that when a Syrian national or any national who enters into Turkey without an official document from Syria enters Turkey, they have the option to declare their own identity. There is no request for a proof. There is no request for an identification document. So I can come and say I am someone else than I am. This is not a problem at first, when I first enter into Turkey. But given the circular nature of movement that is happening at the border, when sort of, you know, a free Syrian army soldier enters into Turkey, gets medical treatment in a camp, and then goes back into Syria, it becomes a problem. Because then the person can sort of claim multiple identities as they're coming and going. Because each time they can act like they're a new person. Biometrics provides a solution to that problem from the perspective of the Turkish government. Because once they get the fingerprint, they'll know that the person is not the person that they claim to be. The first identity will show up in the database. Now, biometrics is also becoming widely available in the sort of permits and identifications that is required, for example, as a prerequisite for the work permit. So there are two forms of identification that an individual that is not Turkish can have to be eligible for the work permit. And that's one is the sort of residency permit, and the other one is called an AFAD card, which is sort of the Prime Minister's Office's Office for Emergency Management. They offer their own card. And given that in Turkey, it's not UNHCR, but rather AFAD, the agency that is associated with the Prime Minister's office that governs the camps. Those IDs are the IDs that let you in and out of the camp or sort of determine your eligibility to be in the camp. So those two identifications are biometric. This is interesting to me precisely because Turkish identifications for Turkish citizens are not biometric. So, and they're starting to become biometric. So one of the things we're looking at is whether these are actually sort of de facto pilot projects for Turkish identification in the first place. What is sort of the, you know, what are some of the ways that these individuals' data is being protected? Because one of my biggest concerns, and I've been expressing this for about 2 years, is that one of the things that we're not talking about is that in this particular case, data is a currency. Data about Syrians, Afghans, Iraqis living in Turkey is a currency in Turkey's negotiations with the European Union. The European Union specifically asked, as one of the conditions of the visa waiver agreement or the visa waiver roadmap, was a data protection law. Turkey, up until this May or April, did not have a data protection law. There was no way of ensuring or establishing state responsibility over these individuals' data. So that's a big problem. So my biggest concern, and so far this hasn't materialized, was, you know, Turkey sort of trading in the data or the biometric information of these Syrians, Afghans, Iraqis living in Turkey with the European Union would be, in from the perspective of the European Union, almost as valuable as keeping, you know, Syrians, Afghans, and Iraqis in Turkey, because they'll get a first-hand information or sort of additional information to compare with Eurodac.
So do you have any sort of smoking gun evidence that this acquisition of data, intelligence gathering purpose, is actually facilitating or playing a role in the formation of this deal, or at least signs that this is what the EU is really interested in?
No, I don't. And I mean, I think that there is information or intelligence gathering on the sort of the foreign fighters phenomenon, like sort of who enters into Turkey and that kind of intelligence gathering. The Turkish government claims that they're being open with the European governments on when they detain someone or when they deport someone. But I don't think that this is at the level of that biometric information yet. And I don't think that it will be for the foreseeable future. But one of the things that I have learned, I know about the European Union, is that crisis becomes a pretty important tool for motivation. And I think that they then sort of develop mechanisms and instruments for, you know, further integration or further sort of sharing as a result of crisis. So I wouldn't really put it past any of either the Turkish government or the European Union institutions to sort of not think about this. I think that they have safeguards against this, but I think that crisis becomes a tool of invention. So I that's my biggest concern as a critical scholar, that I don't want to see this. I don't want this to become, you know, a mechanism. I think this is that would be a very demeaning, very sort of crude way of dealing with this crisis.
Thanks, John. I mean, we're really not getting this sort of detail and insight into the EU-Turkey deal on this side of the Bosphorus. So I'm really glad that you've had the opportunity to come and chat with us today.
You're welcome.
For those of you who are interested in finding out more about John's research, you can find links to his staff page and also links to a sample of his work at our blog, 4mpodcast.com. Monday Morning Meetings on Migration is run by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can access us through iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe for our updates on Twitter or Facebook. As always, if you have suggestions about a story you'd like us to feature or would like to post an audio rejoinder to something that's been said on a previous podcast, please do email us at imes@uva.nl.